Welcome back to The Drive with Kevin Weiss on ESPN Blacksburg, AM 1430, FM 94.1. We've got Chris Coleman from TechSideline.com in studio. And Chris, I was on the website today, and I guess somebody confirmed that Brady Hoke said that Danny Cole did catch that ball at the end of the day.
I think it was somebody who was calling into a radio show that had Brady Hoke, and I think it was Billy Packer's son hosting the show. And they basically got both those guys, including Brady Hoke, to admit that Danny Cole caught that pass in the Sugar Bowl.
There we go.
Which we already knew.
Yeah.
But it's still funny to hear the opposing coach admit.
Right. And then also news broke today with the Brad Paisley concert is official. Are you planning on going to that at all?
Or? Yeah, definitely.
Okay.
I think it's going to be he'll start at 9 o'clock that Sunday night. So, you know, it's going to be a long couple of days, a long 24-hour period there if you're going to the Tech game and the Brad Paisley concert, but it'll be worth it. I mean, you're talking about a guy who's hosted the CMAs tons of times. He's a world famous musician, great guitar player for free. I mean, I'm not gonna pass that up.
Yeah, not bad at all. And on the website, I see now I'm trying to get into fantasy football for the first time in like 5 or 6 years. Are you a big fantasy football guy?
Yeah, I play in a league each year. I've got to set my keepers before our draft. Glad you said that. I'll have to do that later. But yeah, I like fantasy football. I'm not one of those people that does two or three different leagues.
Right.
Though we've got a FanDuel thing that for people like me, actually, that's affiliated through TSL for like, if you're busy and you don't want to play every week, you can play just certain weeks and you have a different lineup each week, you know, depending on who you take for what amount of money, and you can just look at the matchups that week. And you know, if you sign up for that through TSL, you get 3 free months of TSL pass, and you have an opportunity to win money. The top 100 people who play for week one will win money.
Yeah, so I mean, I've got to see.
You can put $5 in and finish 50th and get 3 free months of TSL pass and end up winning $10.
Yeah.
So you're going to it's a win-win situation. All you have to do is play.
Oh, that's a great deal. Yeah, I can't get into fantasy football unless it's for money. There's got to be some kind of end game for me. All right, let's get to some football. With the scrimmage last Saturday, on your end, it was pretty vanilla, right? I mean,
yeah. I expect anything you see in an open scrimmage is going to be vanilla. They might install their goal line this week. You know, if you notice this past week's scrimmage, every time they got down to the 15-20 yard line or something like that, they would turn around and go the other way. That's just because they haven't installed their goal line package yet. So maybe they'll install their goal line this week, and we'll get goal line work in scrimmage number two. They always do that for one of the scrimmages of the fall each year. But I thought it was your normal first scrimmage. A little better than your normal first scrimmage, actually. Normal first scrimmages, the execution generally aren't very good. You see some penalties as guys are getting back into the swing of things. But for the most part, I was pleased. Everybody seemed to line up right for the most part. All the quarterbacks seemed to be in command of the offense. You didn't see a lot of mental errors out there, and that's something we've seen a lot of the last couple of years with as young as this team is. Has been. So maybe that's a sign they're growing up a little bit if they're playing. This is the best first scrimmage I've seen in, you know, since the last time they had experience, probably. So I'll take that as a good sign.
Oh, wow. Well, now, there's been a lot of talk about Dwayne Lawson and his performance in the scrimmage. What were your impressions of him?
Yeah, he's good. He was pretty good when nobody got into his face. The one time somebody got into his face and he stared down that receiver and almost threw a pick six. I mean, that's your typical freshman mistake right there. But, you know, he looked about like I thought he would. He was more accurate than he was on the first day of practice when he was just throwing the ball everywhere that day. But you know, he settled down, probably had a case of the freshman nerves the first day of practice, and I'm sure he's had a lot of technique work with Scott Loeffler since then. But, you know, I think you could see his natural ability out there. I think all you have to do is look at him and see, look, the guy's 6'6", he's already 222 pounds, he's got a great arm like that. He's got all the potential. You just got to be patient with him and give him time to learn the offense, adjust to the speed of the game, and I think he's got a chance to be a really good player.
Would you be opposed to a red shirt, or does it really not matter to you as long as he's working?
As long as he doesn't go to the scout team, I think you got to keep him mentally involved. I'd actually red shirt him and keep him with the regular offense on a week-to-week basis, put him in the meeting room with Scott Loeffler, get him used to game planning. make him one of the signal guys on the sideline. Just keep him involved in the day-to-day operations. When you send a guy to the scout team, they're not even paying any attention to their own offense or their own defense anymore. They're just running the opponent's stuff every week. And you know, that's not necessarily how you get a quarterback ready to potentially start within the next year or two. It's just not going to do him any good spending the whole fall on the scout team. So I'd probably try to redshirt him, but I would keep him near me if I'm the quarterback's coach or offensive coordinator. I'd keep him around me and all the other quarterbacks, let him soak it up as much as he could. That's something he couldn't do with the scout team. So got to keep him involved. The fan in me, you know, it was like, man, I really want to see him in a game. Let's see what he can do. But at the same time, when in doubt, always redshirt, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. You know, it's different if you're at a place like Ohio State or Florida State or Alabama where you're bringing in four-star and five-star guys every year and you can just refill that pipeline every year. When you're a school like Virginia Tech, or most schools, actually, that recruits primarily, you know, your three-star level players, you need to redshirt most of your guys. Redshirt as many guys as you can. Get as many fifth-year guys as you can. And that's how you compete. On the years you have your most experienced teams with your most fifth-year guys, that's when you have the great chance to compete with those teams who might have a little more talent.
Is there a player comparison that you have set with Dwayne Lawson, a guy that you've seen in the past 10 years of college football that you're like, he kind of reminds me of this guy?
Yeah, I mean, when you just compare the physical traits, he kind of reminds you of Vince Young, who's the former Texas quarterback. Vince was listed at 6'5", 232. Dwayne, 6'6", 222, is a true freshman. He's going to end up being bigger than Vince Young. But there's some more players, and I'm not sitting here saying that he's going to lead Virginia Tech to a national championship or compete for the Heisman Trophy or anything like that. But I think he has a very high ceiling, and he's a Vince Young type of player.
Did Chris Durkin and Brendan Motley show you anything, or was it just ho-hum with those guys at the scrimmage?
Chris Durkin has really progressed since the spring. When you saw him in the spring, a lot of times it didn't look like he knew where to go with the ball. He wasn't really in control of the offense. Looked kind of lost. Now, granted, it was really hard to get a good read on the backup quarterbacks in the spring because the backup offensive line was so bad, those guys could barely finish their drops and they were getting sacked. So you really couldn't tell. But I think he looks much more advanced this fall than he did in the spring. This past spring, I was like, ugh. You know, this guy's going to be buried forever. But now I feel a lot better about him based on what I saw in the scrimmage and some other things I've heard. I just think he's more comfortable, has a greater command of the offense now. Brendan Motley, this is his third year in the Scott Leffler system. You know, I don't think he's anywhere close to catching Michael Brewer or anything like that, but you know, I think he'd be a solid, knowledgeable guy to put in the game if something happened to Brewer.
And this is, I mean, there's no quarterback controversy here. It's Brewer's job, and unless he goes down or gets hit and knocked out of the game, there's nobody competing with him for the spot. It's his job.
Yeah, and even if he did get knocked out, I mean, every time that happened last year, he got right back up. I mean, he played hurt for most of last season. I mean, there was times last season, like the first half of the Pittsburgh game, where he was so hurt that he could hardly throw a ball further than 15 yards downfield, and they still didn't take him out of the game. I heard they just gave him a shot at halftime, and he played a lot better in the second half. But, you know, I'm not sure how confident they are in their backups. I mean, if he was that hurt last year and they still didn't take him out, I just don't I think he's their guy, unless he physically is unable to stand up and walk on that football field. Then he's going to be their starter for every game this year.
Now, when I was at the scrimmage, and call me crazy, but I think he was working with the threes, I guess, but a guy on offense that really showed me something was Deshaun McLeese. Mm-hmm. And just his skill set as a scat back, and like when he touched the ball, he had some zoom to him.
He can make people miss.
Yeah.
You know, he can make people miss in the hole. He's not the biggest guy. He's listed at 177 right now. I think I'm actually a couple pounds heavier than him. You know, he's got some good natural running back abilities. I don't think he'll ever play at over 190, 195. He'll never reach the 200-pound mark. He just doesn't have the frame. I could see him contributing on kickoff returns as early as next year. I didn't know what to think about him. I liked his film. I just didn't know how big he was going to be the first time I would ever see him in person. And yeah, I mean, I'm not saying I don't not necessarily think he'll be an every down back or anything like that, but I think he's got some natural skills with the ball in his hands. And you know, Virginia Tech, it's been a while since they had a guy who could just make somebody miss. Mm-hmm. It's been since Tyrod Taylor. You know, they didn't have anybody who could, you know, Logan Thomas would run over you. Even David Wilson, he didn't really make anybody miss. He just ran by him because he was so fast or he was so strong, he'd run over him. But he wasn't, you know, an agile side-to-side type of guy. I think the last offensive player that could really make a guy miss in the hole was Ryan Williams. And you got to go all the way back to, 2009. You know, he played in 2010 also, but, you know, he wasn't a full-time starter. He was hurt for part of that year. So it's been quite a while. It's been a little over a decade since Tech has had a back like that. And McLeese showed a little something on Saturday, so I feel pretty good about his future now.
In turning to the defensive side of the ball, outside of Tim Settle's interception, of course, we all love the bad guy interceptions, and I think you actually noted it. The guy who tackled him from behind, or nobody was going to stand in his way and try to take that hit. But outside of that, were there any defensive players that stood out to you or impressed you from the first scrimmage?
Yeah, you know, I thought it was a pretty good first scrimmage overall for the defense. I really liked what Vinny Mahota did at defensive end. Virginia Tech's got some of their defensive linemen banged up right now. I think all they would all play if a game happened tomorrow, but Daddy Nicholas was out, Corey Marshall was out, Seth Dooley was out. With Daddy and Seth Dooley being out, that pushed Mahota up to with the starting defense, and that means the backup, the number two defense, was a couple of true freshmen in there. But I thought Mahota handled himself really well. He's really, really strong at the point of attack. I think in one-on-one drills, when everybody's just focusing on technique to impress their coach and everything like that, he might not be the best player in the world, but when he actually gets out there and a play is happening, I mean, he was picking people up and throwing them around out there. I mean, Darius Redmond's a redshirt senior, and he had no answer for this redshirt freshman. So I think Mahota is going to be a good player for Virginia Tech. I don't know if he'll stay at defensive end long term, but he might. He's one of those guys that wherever you put him, he's just a good natural football player, and I saw that in the scrimmage on Saturday.
Well, you mentioned a lot of guys sat out in the scrimmage. Should fans be concerned about that, or is that a pretty typical?
It's typical,
okay.
Especially for the first scrimmage. If guys show a sign of getting dinged up early, they'll hold them out. So, you know, you don't want to bring guys back too soon. You don't want them to be banged up for the opener, and especially if they're experienced players. I mean, you're talking about Daddy Nicholas, who's a redshirt senior. Wade Hansen missed the scrimmage. He's a redshirt senior. Those are experienced guys. Corey Marshall's a redshirt senior. I'm not saying those guys don't need to practice, but if you feel the need to hold them out, you can do so comfortably in the knowledge that they're still going to be really, really good. They don't necessarily need as much work as everybody else. So that's pretty typical for this time of year.
We've got Chris Coleman from TechSideline.com in studio. More with him coming up next. You're listening to The Drive with Kevin Weiss on ESPN Blacksburg, AM 1430, FM 94.1. Welcome back to The Drive with Kevin Weiss on ESPN Blacksburg, AM 1430, FM 94.1. We've got Chris Coleman from TechSideline.com in studio. And Chris, over the past couple of days, I've been reading some of the message boards and things out there, and even on Snapchat, it shows Wyatt Teller working with the second team O-line. Are you reading anything into that at all? Do you think he's in Coach Cyril's doghouse, or it's just to kind of get some other guys work with the first team?
I wouldn't say he's in the doghouse. I think it's partly to get other players work with the first team. I think he's trying to take a good hard look at Parker Osterloh right now.
Yeah.
Parker's playing a lot better this year ever since he dropped 20 pounds. They're trying to figure out where he can help, if he's capable of starting, et cetera, et cetera. And sometimes if you got a really, really talented player, like Wyatt Teller, a coach might be a little harder on him to try and make sure he realizes his potential. Like, sometimes I think Steiny might be a little harder on Bucky Hodges than he is on some other guys because, Bucky has such a high ceiling. That's just part of coaching. You coach every player differently. Even if coaches say they don't do that, most of them do. I think you have to coach guys differently. It depends on guys' personalities and things like that. So, I don't think you'd look at that situation and point to any one thing. I'm 100% confident that Wyatt Teller will be in the starting lineup against Ohio State. I'll say that.
Absolutely. And going back to Osterloh, you see him as the swing guy, or is it the 6-0 lineman?
I think he's the 6th offensive lineman. Maybe the 5th, depending on what happens with Wade Hansen. And I still don't know what they would do there, whether they would start him at right tackle and keep Connie at right guard, or if they would move Conti out to tackle and start Osterloh at guard. That's one of the reasons that Searles is moving Osterloh around so much, just to try to figure out his best position and how the line would be moved if somebody got hurt, how players would move around. So when you're an offensive line coach like Stacy Searles, and you feel like you've got a pretty decent group of starters, but maybe only one backup, maybe two, who's capable of playing, I would say just one, then you got to really get creative to try to develop your lineup and figure out what you would do. Ideally, in an ideal world, you have a backup left tackle, a backup left guard, a backup center, right guard, right tackle, and then if one of them gets hurt, you just plug that next guy in who's behind him on the depth chart, but you can't do that. Teams are very rare. I mean, even your best teams don't go 10 deep on the offensive line these days. It's a hard position to recruit. Virginia Tech didn't do a good job of it for several years in a row, and they're paying the price right now. I think they got the right guy as their offensive line coach, but unfortunately, it takes a while to rebuild an offensive line. Jeff Grimes' recruits are only redshirt freshmen this year. Stacy Searles' recruits are true freshmen, so you got to give it 2 to 3 years before you see those results start to pay off.
So is that where you put most of the blame on the last O-line coach for putting them into this situation?
They in 2010 and 2011, Virginia Tech signed a total of 4 offensive linemen. Two of those 4 had no scholarship offers from Power 5 conference schools. Only one of those 4 will ever contribute to Virginia Tech as a starter. So when you get one starter over the course of 2 years, I mean, that's going to destroy your offensive line. That's going to kill your depth down the road. And we're seeing that right now. We're seeing that. There's no way that Nijman, he doesn't need to be the number 2 left tackle right now. I think he's a really talented player. I think he might be a 3-year starter for Virginia Tech. But
he's got to put on like 20 pounds, right?
Yeah,
25 pounds.
Yeah, but he played at 265 in the spring as an offensive tackle, and that shows you how thin Virginia Tech's depth is. They had to move Darius Redmond to offensive tackle from tight end, and they tried to use him as a blocking specialist as a tight end last year early in the season, and he got pushed around. He couldn't block the William and Mary defensive end.
Wow.
And now he's an offensive tackle. So that just shows you the lack of depth up front for Virginia Tech. If those starters stay healthy, I think it'll be a good group. But
that's a big
if they have the wrong injury, then you could see things go downhill in a hurry.
Like, for example, who's the backup center? We know Eric Gallo's the starter, but the backup center, it's anybody's guess.
It's Kyle Chung if he's healthy. And Stacy Searles really likes him, thinks he's a good player, thinks he would have had a chance to start had he been healthy in the spring. But you're talking about a guy who I think has had two shoulder surgeries since he arrived at Virginia Tech, and he's only a redshirt sophomore.
Yeah.
I don't see how he's had enough time on the field. I don't see how he's had enough time in the weight room to actually get himself strong enough to play at this level when you've basically missed 2 of your 3 seasons with shoulder surgeries. I mean, when you have shoulder surgery, you can't lift. If you tear your ACL, you know, you can still do upper body and things like that and keep your core strong. But if you have shoulder surgery, you can't do anything except for maybe leg press. But even then, I don't even see how you could do that effectively. Not very much weight. So you just lose so much with shoulder surgeries that I don't know. If Chong is able to contribute this year, despite all that, then I'll be very impressed. But hopefully he can stay healthy for a year and be able to stick his nose in there next season.
Now, say a guy goes down on the offensive line, and that certainly could happen. I mean, injuries happen. That's just part of the game of football, and especially at the offensive line and even later on in the season. As far as being able to kind of prevent that being a bigger problem, do you see Tech keeping more tight ends in tight and utilizing Sam Rogers as a blocking fullback more, that type of stuff?
That's certainly possible. Even if you go back to the Military Bowl last year, and maybe this happened before and I just didn't notice it, but when I was watching tape of the Military Bowl, a couple of weeks ago, I noticed Ryan Mallick staying in to pass block quite a bit. He's a really good blocker, whether it's in the run game or the pass game. So that's a possibility. You help out whoever your right tackle is with Ryan Mallick. But when you start doing that, then you take away one of your passing options. Every time he lines up right there, you kind of know that, oh, he's staying in to help pass block, or at least staying in to chip before he goes out for a route. I think you you limit your options, so you don't want to have to do that, but it is a possibility.
We're talking to Chris Coleman from TechSideline.com. You're listening to The Drive with Kevin Weiss on ESPN Blacksburg, AM 1430, FM 94.1. Welcome back to The Drive with Kevin Weiss on ESPN Blacksburg, AM 1430, FM 94.1. We've got Chris Coleman from TechSideline.com in studio. And Chris, you guys did an excellent piece on TechSideline.com speaking with Tom Gabbard. What improvements are is he planning to make? Like, starting off with English Field, what does he want to do there on improving that?
You know, I think the plan there is you got to get a bigger press box. You've got to make the stadium look big time. Right now, it looks like a big high school stadium when every other ACC team has what looks like a double A or even some cases a triple A park. So you got to make it look more big time. I think you got to put a video board out there. They're one of the very few Power 5 conference teams in the country without a video board. You got to add some stuff down the right field line, make it more family friendly, things like that. You just got to make it look more big time, and they realize that. Whit Babcock's a baseball guy; he knows stuff like that.
Does he plan to add some suites as well?
Yeah, gonna add some suites. Even if it's only two or three of them, you know, if they get bought, that's at least money coming in. You know, you won't be turning a profit off the sport, but you'll at least be making a little bit of a revenue when you can maybe use that money to invest it back into the program for other improvements. So, you know, I think Witt's a very smart guy when it comes to creating new revenue streams. And, you know, if he can sell some suites in English Field and sell naming rights to English Field, which is I think they're in the middle of doing, I think it's going to be English Field at something park at some point, which is what I think they're going to – I don't know what, but that would make sense to me.
And then moving on to Castle Coliseum, are there some improvements you wanted to make there, or like ripping out some seats?
Yeah, you know, there's a possibility of taking out a lot of those seats in the center sections on each side of the castle and making the seats a little bit bigger, because if you ever sat in those seats, they're really, really small. I mean, they rival Keenan Stadium in North Carolina as far as how small the seats are.
Yeah.
Not very comfortable. So I think you could charge more for those seats if they were a little bit bigger. That will make you lose a little bit of capacity. But as time goes by and HDTV gets bigger and bigger, where Virginia Tech is located, and in our history of basketball, we're not going to sell out a 10,000-seat arena on a consistent basis. I mean, you could take our capacity down to 8,000, 8,500, and we would be fine. And then if we ever got good, you could actually charge more for tickets. I mean, the whole supply and demand thing. So I know the general thought is people want to get bigger and things like that, but I don't think that's right for Virginia Tech basketball. Just the demographics, where we're located, the history of our program, things like that, I don't think that'd be a – I think – pulling seats out and making them more comfortable, and maybe you can charge a higher price. I think that would be best for the athletic department that is, you know, these days, I mean, the name of the game is creating new revenue streams. And that's what it's all about.
And enhancing the fan experience, too, because I'm more want to watch a game on my 55-inch television screen instead of go to the game and have semi-decent seats, or especially an uncomfortable seat at Castle Coliseum.
Yeah, you know, it's one of those things. Castle is awesome when it's filled up. I mean, I even sitting up in the corners, I would rather be at a game, in a big game in Castle, when the crowd's into it being really loud, than watching on TV. But these days, when there's 2,000 people at a game, if that, I mean, you're talking about 15% to 20% of the arena is filled up, and you're watching bad basketball. And yeah, I totally understand people staying home. So you got to win basketball games first and foremost, and then we can worry about whether seats are taken out or added or whatever. But right now, there's certainly no need to add any, and that they could scale back by quite a bit and be just fine.
Did Gabbard say anything about the Merriman Center? Anything he wants to change there?
Yeah, and this is something I wrote about a couple months ago when I came across it online. But you know, it's time to give the Merriman Center on the inside, you know, make it more pleasing to the eye.
Facelift
to get the walls updated with pictures, and it's just very bland. It was a very nice facility when it was opened in 1998, but when you look online, go look at Ole Miss's facility or even UVA's, and they're just miles ahead of what Virginia Tech's is right now as far as graphical updates. And you know, I think Kevin Jones was involved in that process, and it's going to cost about $1.7 million, but it's needed, and it's relatively cheap compared to facilities upgrades in college athletics these days. And you know, I think he told me they expect to start on that maybe around the middle of this football season. I don't know how long it'll take, but you know, by next springtime, I figure it'll probably be finished.
And you guys will have a part two on Gabbard as well,
yeah.
Like
his life. His life per se, but how he met former athletic director Jim Weaver, how he got into the business of athletics, how he came to Virginia Tech, and you know, just some old stories from a guy who's been around Virginia Tech for almost 20 years now.
Wow. Like, he owns like a real estate business or something,
yeah,
in Florida, right?
Yeah, most people don't take that route to being college athletic administrators. Owned his own real estate business. That's how he knew Jim Weaver and got into college athletics through Jim as a facilities man. So it's a real interesting story.
Very cool. Well, going back to football for a second, you guys have a poll on TechSideline.com, the toughest road game this season, and just taking Georgia Tech out of the equation, what would you see?
Oh, you can put Georgia Tech back in the equation, and I'm still saying Boston College.
Okay, there we go.
Virginia Tech's last six meetings at Boston College, both teams have won three games, and both teams have scored exactly 130 points. It doesn't get any closer than that. I mean, you go play at Boston College, and it's generally a noon game, and it's not a college town. You've got a small alumni base. There's less than 25,000 people. A lot of times the game is in November, so it's freezing cold.
Yeah.
There's no atmosphere in the stadium at all. And it's just a boring, boring place to play. I mean, I remember Tyrod Taylor's senior year, Virginia Tech went up there. And Virginia Tech, they were a great offense in Tyrod's senior year. I mean, they blew everybody out that year after the first two games. I mean, nobody could stop that offense. Now they go up to Boston College, and Tech won the game like 19-0, but it was... You go up there with Tyrod Taylor and David Wilson and Ryan Williams and Jarrett Boykin and Danny Cole and just a bunch of studs on the offensive side of the ball. You look kind of lost all day and you only score 19 points. It's that kind of atmosphere. It's just boring. I wish they hadn't invited them into the ACC. It's just Boston College has always bored me. And that's nothing against Boston College. It's a great school, but...
It kind of reminds me of Rutgers. Boring football to me, anyway.
Well, it's even worse than Rutgers because it's a small private school.
Yeah.
At least Rutgers is a big state school with a bigger alumni base. And if Rutgers does get good, then people will show up. But even when Boston College is good, man, it's just... I'm just not a big fan of it. That's my number one. If Virginia Tech was playing at Pittsburgh, that would be my number one.
Mm-hmm.
But Boston College is Tech will be up for the Georgia Tech game.
Yeah.
There's no question. Virginia Tech will, and you know that they generally play very well down there. We've lost to Paul Johnson more in Lane Stadium than we have. Or is that accurate? Yeah, that's accurate. I think. I'm trying to remember.
You'd have to go back.
Yeah, I'd have to go back and look.
But either way, it's going to be. I mean, since Steve Adazio has taken over at least for Boston College, you know they're going to play tough,
sure,
physical football. And I really like what Adazio has done at Boston College, of all things. Now, what about a home game outside of Ohio State that you're circling on the schedule? Like, this could be a tough one.
Would
it be Pitt, that first conference game? Or North Carolina State the next week?
You know, I really like Pitt. I think they're a physical football team, but... Virginia Tech just plays bad at Pitt. I don't think they're going to play bad against Pitt because Pitt's kind of the same story as Boston College. There's nobody in that stadium and things like that. But
because I know Tech's coming off two road games,
yeah,
and then they've got Pitt.
Then they've got Pitt. Yeah, so I mean, it could conceivably be tough. The two I circle are the two North Carolina teams that are coming to Lane State. Well, besides Duke, North Carolina State and North Carolina. Jacoby Brissett, the North Carolina State quarterback, man, that guy only threw like five interceptions last year and 370 pass attempts. He had a great season, and nobody ever talks about him. And this is year three of that coaching staff, and And I think their players are starting to buy in. They won a bowl game last year. So I'm circling that game, and I'm circling the North Carolina game. North Carolina's got a very talented offense with Marquise Williams. Larry Fedora is an excellent offensive coach. Hire Gene Chizik to fix the defense in the offseason. If he comes through, they're a sleeper in the Coastal. So I'm kind of circling that one as well.
Yeah, both those teams, dangerous offenses. Because in addition to Brissett, North Carolina State has those like three or four running backs that they can go to, and of course North Carolina.
They got
Carolina
a stable back there
as well. The Coastal is just going to be. I'm very curious to see how that winds out. Mm-hmm. It's going to be a lot of fun. All right, Chris, we appreciate it, and we'll talk to you next week.
Sounds good.
You're listening to The Drive with Kevin Weiss on ESPN Blacksburg. We'll see you tomorrow. Peace.
All sports, all the time.
Have I been talking out my butt?
ESPN Blacksburg, AM 1430, FM 94.1, on the Sports...